Atlantic Declaration is issued. The U.S. and the United Kingdom unite. In 1943, the top secret Brusa Agreement is signed to spy on German communications exclusively between the United States and the United Kingdom. Eavesdropping networks are interconnected. Thus, encryption, penetration, and code breaking take on more serious form. Newspapers scare people and pressure politicians. Eisenhower thinks about bridging the gap and speaks of the need to establish a base. 4 days later, Secretary of Defense Neil McElroy speaks in Congress about the formation of an organization that will be responsible for building missiles and carrying out space projects to ward off the emerging danger. This organization is called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. This organization begins to operate under the management of Johnson from General Electric. Roy Johnson has become the director of ARPA while leaving his job as an executive assistant and a salary of $160,000 to work at ARPA. The budget of $520 million for ARPA is approved. Identifying devices on the network was an important issue that was resolved with IP. Each system had a unique number in order to maintain technical aspects and comply with the Department of Defense policies. ICANN was formed. ICANN, headquartered in California, became the name and number assigner of systems on the internet. These identifiers included domain names, IP addresses, and many other parameters. Interestingly, the U.S. government still has the privilege of verifying domain names on the internet. It also controls the purchase and sale of domains. With Echelon, privacy was lost forever. Shamrock, the Minaret program, the Counterintelligence program, and the Chaos program. The latter was a special program of the CIA and FBI to discredit the opposition, and it was different from the program that was specifically designed to spy on students. Echelon had been picked and chosen and had a specific plan to spy on every protest in the Washington, D.C. area. Mike Frost, who was responsible for installing spy equipment inside the embassies, made the revelation. The leaks reached the embassy buildings. He said that sophisticated receivers and processors were secretly transported to the embassies in diplomatic packages and bags, and after being installed, were used for espionage.
See that structure at the top that looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top? I watched them build that, I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his words. The equipment installed in the American Embassy in Geneva and the American Embassy in Berlin was also of the same type. This part of Echelon was called the stateroom. The stateroom. Echelon services were getting better and better, and Mike Frost had more to confess. Echelon had also been used to spy on two members of the British cabinet by order of Margaret Thatcher. Echelon's footprint was also seen at Princess Diana's palace and in the Mossad's revenge operation for the Munich incident. In 2000, CIA Director James Woolsey confirmed that Echelon was also involved in industrial and commercial espionage for financial reasons. This led to the massive Boeing contracts and unemployment for European companies and professionals. America was also stealing European jobs. A delegation from the European Union traveled to Washington, but all meetings were canceled by the United States, forcing the committee to end its trip early. The U.S. did not respond to the demands.
Come on, fire!
On September 11, 2001, a strange incident occurred. two planes crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was shocked and emotional. No one saw the engineered collapse of the towers. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators had to be caught and punished. These events led to the public being monitored along with the terrorists. Echelon's abuses were forgotten, and Echelon was tasked with fighting terrorism against all odds. The war on terror began. At a later time, the United States tried to form a coalition to attack Iraq. Until then, Western officials had considered Echelon's features and services insignificant and minor, but when Colin Powell revealed the conversations of Ba'athist commanders about hiding chemical weapons to convince members of the Security Council to attack Iraq, Echelon's incredible capabilities in recording conversations were revealed. Conversations were converted into text. Echelon was more than what was stated. In 2003, the United States attacked Iraq, and murder and killing increased subsequently. Julian Assange started making disclosures. After launching WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of leakers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, the young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked for the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton, a security contractor for the Department of Defense, made a major disclosure during an interview. The NSA had been conducting widespread spying on everything, even social media. The internet is not safe.
Targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the intelligence cooperation of Western countries during the Cold War contained the most hidden secrets of the Western world. The Protect American Act of 2007 had led to the creation of a secret program. A program to collect two types of data, metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There really was a conspiracy. Google, which was the source for many people to search, watch movies and send emails, was at the heart of the PRISM. All information and activities of users on the internet were recorded, and the NSA had amazingly direct access to the data of Google and other internet giants such as Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small businesses. It stored them easily. The organization had worked magic. The encryption software itself had become a spying agent. For example, journalists used the Tor software to hide their identities. They were supposed to use Tor to prevent them from being tracked and their identities from being revealed. But that was not the case. That was a big lie, in fact. Everything was under the watchful eye of the organization. Only 10% of the internet was available to ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was controlled by the NSA. Snowden also disclosed Bull Run and XKeyscore. These programs were used to encrypt online communications and data, and the amount allocated for them was $800 million. The situation became critical, and the matter went to the Senate. In the Senate hearing, James Clapper was called to account. He was asked if the NSA had recorded data or information from the American people. Clapper said no. Perjury led to Clapper's dismissal. In the UK, the situation was worse. Although the British spy agency had a system that detected encrypted communications inside cable networks, it was desperately seeking to penetrate Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their spy program was Tempora, which began in 2008 and went into operation in 2011. A Another program was called Edge Hill. These programs had a strange feature. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques, and for example, Edge Hill, which cost over $250 million a year, cracked email passwords, bank documents, and medical records, penetrated VPNs and secure layers, and was in the process of penetrating fourth-generation smartphones. This program was intentionally damaging the equipment. It was really dangerous software. Why was the equipment, though, so vulnerable? After designing and manufacturing the product, companies were required by law to send their products to the organization for regulatory testing in accordance with U.S. legal requirements. By making changes to the design, the NSA and CIA made the equipment sent by the companies traceable and even turned it into a spy tool. The NSA was also planning to spy via hubs and free Wi-Fi-like routers. Verizon's phone software, with 100 million customers, was also used for spying. The documents show that the agency had also penetrated international standards that rely on encryption systems and introduced weaknesses in security standards. Snowden's death blow was at the concept of standards in information technology. The agency had secretly worked to get its version into a security standard proposal issued by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, approved for use worldwide in 2006. The standard also served the NSA. It was as if the spy race was heating up. The FBI and CIA were aware of the weaknesses of intelligence systems, but they didn't tell anyone because of espionage and exploited these vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to avenge 9/11 began with extensive espionage. The main platform for espionage was the internet, but this was not all of the revenge's plan. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, "You are either with us or against us," led to the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. Groundwork was laid for international intranets. The Eyes Alliance was formed. 9 Eyes, 14 Eyes, and 40 Eyes. Information was classified and was only provided with guarantees and in a limited manner. The game had begun. After a year of effort, a 27 terabyte database was created by the Bagram Airfield, which stored regional information. Polish soldiers who were sent to Afghanistan went to difficult and remote places that Americans would not go. In return for the favor, they received an interceptor from the United States and tried to help the U.S. quite a bit. But they did not become a member of the Afghan Intelligence Coalition. Poland, along with several other NATO countries, was on the red list. English-speaking countries with historical and cultural roots in the British Isles cooperated more closely with one another than any other countries, even in the occupation of Afghanistan. The Iraqi coalition was different because they were faced with a larger population. The organization rolled up its sleeves and spied on 4 to 5 million Baghdad residents simultaneously. The White House, the Department of Defense, the FBI, and the CIA each had their own intranets, and it was later revealed that the number of networks was much greater than was disclosed. Eventually, top secret intranets were revealed that carried sensitive SCI information. Intelink and Intellipedia were programs for intelligence and institutional forces to share information from around the world. Among their topics of interest were Iran's nuclear activities, which led to the production of the Stuxnet malware, as well as information showing who strongly opposed the invasion of Iraq and what the national intelligence estimates were in different countries. In 2013, the cost of the CIA, which overthrew governments, increased to $15 billion, and the NSA, which only did digital work, spent at least $10.5 billion. Their excuse, to protect America's security.
Necessary to do the job to protect the American people from further attack.
The NSA's heavy investment will allow it to advance to the point where it can monitor all smartphones and completely surveil individuals in 2018. This means each and every single cellular phone device, meaning no phone was safe.
Are not especially good in protecting your privacy. Think right now.
What the NSA does is about cryptography. It's the largest employer of mathematicians in the world, both directly and indirectly. The NSA has the largest supercomputers on the planet. The minimum electricity bill for the headquarters in Maryland is $21 million. The NSA monitors the entire process of sending information in any form. That is, an email that goes from one room to the next is monitored by the NSA. Where does the NSA's power come from? The NSA is administratively part of the Department of Defense and works under the supervision of the DNI. The NSA director also serves as the director of the Central Security Service. The NSA specializes in signals intelligence and provides services to other intelligence agencies. The basis for the NSA's extensive activities is the Communications Act and the National Security Act. The Communications Act was consolidated in 1996, and this law is derived from a 1934 law that is still in effect. Under Section 706 of this Act, the President is authorized to monitor all communications if there is a threat of war. That is, he can even shut down the Internet. But the Internet is formed based on activities of companies that establish Internet services and are known as the backbone of the Internet. In 2010, senators claimed intellectual and material ownership of the Internet so they could shut it down at will. So they voted in the House to consider the Internet a national asset. The bill was defeated without a vote. The reason for the no vote was the benefits that the U.S. itself derived directly and indirectly from the public Internet. The Internet was a source of vast revenue and espionage that could not be exclusively reserved for one country. The U.S. economy depended on the Internet, the NSA, and DARPA. In this economic model, conditions had to be such that everyone was eager to use the Internet. The Internet was an attractive factor that facilitated other programs. It played the role of a catalyst. On the other hand, the Internet shutdown was a source of fear for other countries and made them prefer to build a national information network. The construction of equipment by other countries resulted in a decrease in the level of espionage. Therefore, it was concluded the national information network should not be built by other governments and people should be busy using it with the slogan of the public Internet so that intelligence agencies can carry out their missions easily. U.S. intelligence agencies were formed under the National Security Act and expanded rapidly until their number reached 17 main organizations and a large number of subsidiaries. The cost of intelligence activities in the U.S. is financed under two programs, the National Intelligence Program and the Military Intelligence Program. The total cost of these two programs increased from $72 billion in 2013 to about $86 billion in 2020. The custodians of these two programs and all other organizations are called the U.S. Intelligence Community, IC. IC calls itself a federation of its member elements. It sets goals and priorities, and it spends billions of dollars on various intelligence projects. Some projects are in the form of 10-year spy programs, some are longer. The IC's power increased in the 1980s, just as information analysis was gaining attention in order to help politicians with data mining, in fact, discovering cheaper ways to solve America's problems. Information was growing rapidly, and managing it was a very difficult task. The solution was spending money for the projects, the same policy that led to the formation of DARPA and advanced systems in previous decades. A project called the Large Digital Information Systems was formed. The project management was entrusted to the university. At the request of the CIA, the University of Virginia scientist Dr. Anita Jones became director of DARPA. She had been on the board of directors of the Mitre Corporation since 1988. For this reason, she pursued the project through the Mitre Corporation.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's genocidal aggression in Gaza has resulted in the killing of some 150 academics, 760 teachers, more than 12,000 students, and the complete or partial destruction of 494 schools and higher education institutes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Salma Al-Hindi, 21, is facing an uncertain future. A math undergraduate, Salma saw her university, Al-Azhar, destroyed in November 2023 when the Zionist regime military bombed the campus. Since then, and displaced with her family from their home in the Al-Nasr neighborhood of Gaza City to a tent inside the grounds of Al-Nasr Pediatric Hospital, Al-Hindi has struggled. She asked in January when talking to the Electronic Intifada, "How am I supposed to study? For the past 15 months, my family and I have been living in a tent without electricity, internet, or a computer." To make matters worse, Al-Hindi said her course textbooks were lost forever when her family's house was bombed in October 2023. She's far from alone. The Zionist regime airstrikes and shelling, along with controlled demolitions, have completely or partially destroyed every single one of Gaza's 12 higher education institutes. According to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, 88,000 university students have been unable to pursue their studies, and at least 555 students from Gaza have had to forego on the opportunity to use scholarships they had been offered abroad. Al-Hindi told the Electronic Intifada, "I don't know what to do. I'm worried about my future, which is slipping away before my eyes. The Israeli war on Gaza has destroyed the future of thousands of university students. The occupation has destroyed everything in Gaza. The situation hasn't changed after the declaration of a ceasefire and the supposed suspension of the Zionist regime's attacks. She said she's still busy helping provide for her family's daily needs, such as finding water and collecting firewood to cook food and to heat their tent. Despite the difficulties, Al-Hendi said she was not giving up and will find a way to complete her studies. She hoped foreign governments, aid agencies, and universities would step in to support education in Gaza by any means possible. As far back as April, a panel of United Nations experts suggested Israel's systematic destruction of education institutions could be considered an intentional effort to comprehensively destroy the Palestinian education system in Gaza. Taysir Al-Saif, 23, was on the verge of graduating with a degree in information technology from University of Palestine, destroyed in January last year, when she and four of her family members were displaced to the Deir al-Balah camp in Az-Zaytun neighborhood in eastern Gaza City on November 8, 2023. Al-Saif said in January about quitting the program after a month, "I joined the e-learning system at the university, but I couldn't continue due to the lack of internet, the power outages, and the general insecurity." She recalled walking some 3 miles every day to reach a cafe with a strong enough internet connection for her to download the materials and study summaries provided online by her professors. But these efforts also proved unsustainable, as it cost her $3 an hour to use the internet. Al-Saif said, "We were supposed to be taking our final exams for the first semester these days. Everything has been postponed, but until when? No one knows." She said she hoped the ceasefire could provide her and other students with opportunities to resume their education, even despite the wholesale destruction of universities. "It will be a gradual process. The first realistic option would be to continue studying via online educational programs, while educational institutions are rebuilt to allow students to gradually return. Temporary or alternative educational centers could also be constructed in Gaza." Al-Saif said she still considers herself lucky. Many of her fellow students were killed over the 15 months, and even after the ceasefire came into, Israeli regime attacks have continued and are a source of anxiety for everyone in Gaza. She asked, "How can a student study when they know they are at risk of being killed at any moment, with the constant threat of a missile possibly hitting their home or tent, or the homes and tents of their neighbors?" Nasser Gayounin, 29, was enrolled in a master's math program at the Islamic University of Gaza, which the Zionist regime military deliberately targeted in October 2023, destroying most of its buildings. He said, "I was supposed to graduate in the spring of 2024, but then my future was turned upside down, and my dreams changed from being an educated person to working in a cafe to provide for my family's basic needs." He described 2024 as a lost year. He said, "I lost my textbooks, I lost friends, I lost professors, and I don't know what will happen to us this year. Everything has evaporated." Ceasefire or not, the destruction in Gaza has been devastating. Reconstruction will be a massive task, and he feared it would be years before education could be properly restarted. He said, "The university can no longer be used for studying. Everything is destroyed. Classrooms, labs, all its facilities. Returning while things are in this condition is extremely difficult, and Gaza may need years to restore its education sector." Salah Abdulati, chairman of the International Commission to Support Palestinian Rights Group, accused the Zionist regime of trying to obliterate education in Gaza by specifically targeting higher education institutes. He said, targeting universities, schools, and academies is a violation of international humanitarian law and infringes on the right to education. Moreover, he added, the deliberate targeting of universities is unlawful as per Article 8 of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which classifies deliberate attacks on civilian objects as war crimes and violations of the Hague and Geneva Conventions. With such clear breaches of international law, Abdulati said Israel must be held accountable and the individuals who issued, executed, or participated in such attacks should be prosecuted before the ICC. The Zionist regime's genocidal aggression has resulted in the killing of some 150 academics, 760 teachers, more than 12,000 students, and the complete or partial destruction of 494 schools and higher education institutes. Ala Bani Fadel, a professor of criminal law and human rights at Al Najah National University, said on January 8, by targeting universities in the Gaza Strip, the occupation deliberately contributed to the destruction of the academic environment, which has long been a significant source of motivation and innovation. The complete halt in the educational process has deprived the students of their right to education in both the present and future, as well as denying faculty members their right to work. In such a situation, distance learning becomes the only method for continuing coursework, he said. But like many other educators, Bani Fadel reported experiencing firsthand problems caused by inconsistent internet access, weak telecommunications, and frequent power outages. He said, Gaza's universities will need a significant amount of time to restore their activities following the massive destruction they have endured. He said it was essential to encourage students to immediately enroll in Arab and international universities to complete their education. Academics must raise their voices and share their struggles with the world by communicating with human rights and academic organizations to highlight the devastating reality of the education sector in Gaza.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for all people. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, here on IRB English Radio. So I've titled the topic for today, Respect for All People. And I'm going to actually narrow it down a little bit. So I'm talking, first of all, about a little incident from the life of the famous martyr Ibrahim Hadi. So during the War of Holy Defence, also called the Imposed War, some of the Iraqi captives had been brought to the city where he was. And so he had responsibility to look after them. And so what was happening was that so he gave them food. And so obviously, so this meant that the captives were also sort of, in a sense, attracted to this good behavior, this good akhlaq of his. And he'd also talk with them. So he was displaying just such good care and behavior towards them that they even wanted to fight with him against the Ba'athis. So, and you know, this is something, there were some very, let's say, meaningful outcomes of his behavior towards captives, for example, towards their, like their enemies, basically, such that Some of the Iraqis obviously did fight with them. Then they went and they formed a unit, and yes, some of them became some of the sort of very famous martyrs on the Iranian side. So, but obviously this is about what does this mean, respect for all people? So this is very specific, and look, even nowadays in the region, we see this, that we have very strict rules, even with enemies, and especially when we're taking, for example, what we call captives, or prisoners of war. And this is spelled out for us very much so in the Quran. And Imam Ali would talk about this, how we're supposed to treat the captives in war, for example. Welcome back. This is A to Z and RB English Radio. And so I'm talking about respect for people, and I've been talking about how, for example, Ibrahim Hadi, the famous martyr, would treat the captives of war from Iraq during the War of Holy Defense. And obviously, so respecting people and also respecting and caring properly about the captives, the prisoners of war, this sort of goes together. And there's two strands to this, obviously. One is that we appreciate the other person's dignity as a human being. So even if this is our enemy, even if this is a prisoner of war. And there's another element in there that is really important, because imagine if, you know, and let's just sort of talk about this in a more general way. If we are, let's say, whether you want to think about people you really don't like, or call them enemies, maybe there's just people you really don't like at work. And, you know, obviously, so let's take it down to the micro level. First, you've got people at work, maybe you've got a boss, or maybe you have some very troublesome, let's say, members of family in the bigger extended family, and you're thinking, oh, this person's akhlaq is terrible. Why can't I behave like that towards them? No, we shouldn't be like that. If we then counter them with really good akhlaq, very often, not always, of course, but very often, that sort of stops them from even being able to sort of continue with bad akhlaq, because it surprises people. It's difficult, genuinely, for people to counter, like, say, kindness with unkindness. So, you know, we might already sort of be doing the right thing just through doing that. And obviously, if we take it to the bigger level, the macro level, again, imagine, obviously, if we as Muslims, if we're treating, you know, in the political arena, if we've got prisoners of war, if we have captives, you know, if we are the ones who are treating them really well, exactly the way we should, as per the Quran, then obviously people will be looking at us and thinking, oh, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Look at how well they're being treated. That is Islam. Because, you know, as Muslims, both in our small spheres and in the global arena, it's our role to always be the best people we can be. Every single one of us is representing and propagating Islam through our behavior, inshallah. So thank you for listening in for today, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
English Radio. a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah's martyred leader, Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah, Palestine was not a regional conflict, but rather the soul of humanity's struggle. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Hezbollah's martyred leader Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah was laid to rest on Sunday, 23rd of February, in the presence of millions of his admirers who have flocked to Beirut to attend his historic funeral. While he's not physically around anymore, his death does not mean the end of his mission. His martyrdom on 28th of September last year marked an eruption of a volcanic force that will reshape history and inspire future generations of resistance fighters and justice seekers. His pure blood, like that of all martyrs of the resistance front, will fuel the unquenchable fire of justice, the struggle against oppression, and the unyielding march towards freedom of Palestine. His burial ceremony transcended grief. It was a global phenomenon of defiance, echoing from Lebanon's valleys to Gaza's rubble-strewn streets, from Yemen's rugged mountains to every corner where the oppressed rise against Western imperialism and Zionism. The martyred leader of the Islamic resistance movement in Lebanon stood unshaken, while others in the Arab world faltered. He forged not merely an organization, but a movement whose legacy will grow bigger and brighter. His ideology rejected colonial humiliation, declaring sovereignty non-negotiable and dignity inviolable. He was not a politician but an institution that reshaped the equations of power in West Asia region and strengthened the resistance front against the Zionist regime. His strength was not inherited. It was formed in the crucible of wars, seizures, assassinations, and relentless psychological warfare against the resistance front. Hezbollah, born under the shadow of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, led by the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, became a force to be reckoned with under his leadership. It became a parallel society, a fortress of dignity, shielding the oppressed, defying occupiers, and rewriting the rules of resistance. We continue with Press TV's coverage of this story. Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah's speeches were not mere addresses, but powerful salvos aimed at the enemy. In his iconic spider's web speech, he dismantled the myth of Israeli invincibility with a single phrase, "Israel is weaker than a spider's web." These words shattered decades of Zionist propaganda, exposing the fragility of their so-called military might. Distilling Hezbollah's creed into three immutable principles, dignity, resistance, and defiance, he declared, "We are a people who will not be humiliated." Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah's leadership was inseparable from Imam Khomeini's revolutionary theology, a doctrine where faith is action, martyrdom is victory, and resistance is divine. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, sharpened this vision, declaring, "The path to Al-Quds is paved with resistance. Together, they transformed faith into a blueprint for revolution, merging spirituality with resistance. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's unbreakable bond with Haj Qasem Soleimani, Iran's anti-terrorism commander, epitomized this creed. Their alliance was no diplomatic formality, but a blood oath, forged in the heat of battle for Palestine's liberation. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah urged his followers in his final remarks. He said, "Follow Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It was a sacred pledge to preserve and protect the revolution led by Ayatollah Khamenei." Ayatollah Khamenei's heartfelt eulogy for Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, calling him "my brother and my pride," was also no political gesture. It was a covenant, a vow that the axis of resistance would bend to no empire and to no threat and no compromise. It was a beautiful tribute to what the martyred Hezbollah leader did for the resistance front for decades. He walked the path of Karbala, where Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny left a legacy. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said, "Imam Hussein stood alone, but his cry shook empires. Martyrdom is not death, it is immortality." This philosophy materialized in 2000, when Hezbollah expelled Israeli occupation forces from southern Lebanon, marking the Arab world's first military victory over the Israeli regime. In 2006, during Israel's 33-day war, Hezbollah's resilience stunned the world. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah turned martyrdom into a weapon, vowing, "Every drop of blood writes Zionism's obituary." Website of Iran's English-language newspaper Kayhan has also covered this story and tells us more. For Hezbollah's martyred leader, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Palestine was not a regional conflict, but rather it was the soul of humanity's struggle. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah proclaimed, "We fight not for the land, but for justice." Under Ayatollah Khamenei's guidance, Hezbollah's arms, intelligence networks, and alliances became lifelines for Palestine resistance. As Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said, "To abandon Palestine is to surrender the future." Nasrallah was no ordinary leader. He was a master strategist who could outsmart and outpower the enemy despite limited resources. He outmaneuvered empires with his sharp wit and wisdom, exposing Zionism's fatal flaw, arrogance. He once said, "They study our weapons, but they fear our will." He warned, "Political Islam withers when it trades dignity for power." Hezbollah thrived because it adhered to Imam Khomeini's path, the path of resistance, construction, and never compromise. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's martyrdom is not an epilogue, it is a prologue. As Zubur al-Muqawamah notes in his book, "The blood of the righteous does not vanish. It courses through history's veins, breathing life into the struggle." The axis of resistance is no mere alliance, but a hurricane, uprooting collaborators and cowards from Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's shadow looms. Ayatollah Khamenei reminded us that the road to liberation is paved with martyrs. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's blood now fuels a new generation. Hamas in Gaza hurling Molotov, fighters in Syria reclaiming villages, and students in Tehran chanting "Death to America." His life screamed one truth: resistance is eternal. His legacy is not stone memorials, but rage that burns in every child who throws a stone, every mother who defies checkpoints, every fighter who chants "death to Israel." The great revolution that Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, started, Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei continued, and Sayed Hassan Nasrallah armed, cannot be stopped. As Zionism trembles and empires decay, his voice thunders across time. The spider's web collapses. The dawn rises. The martyrs are watching. The fight goes on, and Seyyed Hassan Nasrallah's flame will never die.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the commanders of the Iran's Air Force and Air Defense Force. The meeting took place on February 7th, 2025, in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on the anniversary of the historic Air Force Commander's Pledge of Allegiance to Imam Khomeini in 1979. Negotiations with the United States have no effect on solving the country's problems. Of course, there are problems inside the country. No one denies that problems exist. There are many problems in people's livelihoods. Almost all segments of society face hardships and challenges. However, that which solves these problems is an internal factor. The internal factor is the determination of committed Iranian officials and the cooperation of a united Iranian nation. This is exactly what you will witness in the upcoming rally, God willing, the unity of the people. Every year, the rally on 22nd of Bahman is a demonstration of national unity in our country. A perceptive nation and indefatigable officials are what will solve our problems. The officials are busy working. Praise God, they are getting things done. And I am very hopeful that this esteemed administration will at least be able to ease people's difficulties in their livelihood and remove their hardships. The US is sitting and redrawing the map of the world on paper, but it's only on paper and has no relation to reality whatsoever. They make comments about us, talk, give opinions, and issue threats. If they threaten us, we will threaten them. If they carry out their threat, we will carry out our threat. If they disrupt the security of our nation, we will definitely disrupt their security as well. This approach is taken from the Quran, is the command of Islam, and is our duty. We hope Almighty God grants us success in carrying out our duties.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
April 26th, 2022. I used to go to the University of Tehran every week, without any exception. This dates back to 40 years ago, not now. There, students would gather and pose their questions, and I would provide answers. Thus, many problems would be resolved, and many feelings would be expressed. In certain cases, there were no answers for the criticisms made, and we understood that there was a need for something to be done. Such problems must be resolved. I have advised officials in various organizations and ministers to come and hold discussions with you. Well, the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were mentioned here. These organizations must step forward and speak. Many of these criticisms can be explained. Of course, in certain cases, there may not be good explanations, and the other side will understand the need for taking action in that regard. This is a point that I wanted to raise so that you will take it into consideration.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Nigerian Senate said the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is accused of sponsoring terrorist groups, including the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram. The Nigerian legislative body said this is a weighty allegation which should be thoroughly investigated. The lawmakers said USAID and other non-governmental organizations had given many Nigerians cause to question their motives in the troubled northeast of Nigeria. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Jazaki, has always said that the United States and other Western countries are complicit in the sponsor of Boko Haram terrorists in Nigeria. Boko Haram is an insurgent group that started in 2009 and has killed tens of thousands of Nigerians in frequent brutal attacks. Over 2 million Nigerians have been displaced from their homes, in addition to destruction of hospitals, schools, and basic infrastructure by Boko Haram. The allegation that said that USAID is sponsoring Boko Haram, another terrorist, came as a startling revelation to many Nigerians, but experts are not surprised.
When you look at the antecedents of the United States, you see that they have been involved in either financing or stoking ember of discord around the world, only to further their own cause. For example, after they damaged Libya, damaged Iraq, and tried to damage Afghanistan, this was when they began to send in their military-industrial complexes.
Experts argue that if allegations of USAID sponsoring terrorism prove true, it would be a striking irony. The United States has long presented itself as a global leader in counterterrorism, but such a revelation would severely undermine its moral authority on the world stage. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
The Zulfaqar military exercises officially begun in southern Iran, covering the Mokran coasts, the Oman Sea, and the northern Indian Ocean. All four branches of the country's military units, with their infantry, armored and mechanized forces, along air defense systems, warships, and submarines, are involved. These drills are designed to enhance Iran's readiness and strengthen its defensive capabilities against any potential threat.
The goal of these exercises is to strengthen our defense and deterrence capabilities against any ground, air, or maritime threats, while also testing new tactics. By conducting such drills, we'll be evaluating new, smart, and precise weapons and ammunition, including all types of domestically made